When it comes to maximizing time in the uplands, without fail, Onyx Hunt is my most valuable tool. From planning my next hunt through a new bird cover to navigating in the field, Onyx Hunt is truly with me wherever I go. With detailed mapping and satellite imagery, along with a multitude of map layers from land access to forestry and habitat information, and easy-to-use tools to mark, measure, and catalog important information, Onyx Hunt seamlessly integrates digital scouting with boots-on-the-ground time in the field. With offline mapping and Apple CarPlay integration, you are free to explore the wild landscapes our beloved upland birds inhabit. Planning your next move in the uplands begins with knowing where you stand, and for me, that starts and stops with Onyx Hunt. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your Onyx Hunt subscription. When the miles rack up faster than your flush count, that's when you'll truly appreciate your hunting vest from Final Rise. Built for the uplands and proudly sewn in the USA, the complete lineup of hunting vests from Final Rise, from their all-new Summit XT down to the minimalist Sidekick system, are all built upon the foundational load-bearing waist belt and low-profile shoulder strap system, which allow you to carry all the gear you need and do so comfortably while maintaining your ability to move freely and perform when you need to most. With a complete lineup of accessories and newly released performance field apparel, Final Rise has the gear you need to help you get the most out of every mile and every flush. Final Rise gear is built for the uplands. Get yours today at finalrise.com. This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, the number one GPS hunting app, and Final Rise, premium quality, made in USA hunting vests and field apparel, and Upland Gun Company, custom built and fit, handcrafted Italian shotguns. Hey everybody, welcome in and welcome back to episode number 267 of the Birdshot Podcast. We're talking with California-based dog trainer, hunting guide, and upland hunter, Maddie Rawlinson, today and next week. Stay tuned for Maddie in just a minute, but first I will quickly thank Patreon patrons of the Birdshot Podcast, those of you out there making voluntary contributions in support of the show. I thank you for your support as always. We sent out another Onyx Elite subscription card last week, and we'll do so again at the end of the month. If you want to be eligible for that giveaway, get access to some bonus content, and get hooked up with a set of the Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers. Best way to do that is to go to patreon.com/birdshot. All right, don't forget you can always rate and review the Birdshot Podcast if you love the show in the podcast app that you are listening to. Subscribe to the show, follow the show, whatever options your podcast player gives you. That does help the Birdshot Podcast, and I appreciate anyone taking the time to do that as well. Okay, before we talk to Maddie, I got one more thing for you, kind of a Birdshot Podcast inbox segment. I got asked a couple of times via Instagram this week about boots, specifically the Crispy boots that I've mentioned from time to time. I've been hunting with them for the last two seasons, which would be the Crispy Laponia 2 boots. And one listener also asked me about my gum leaf boots as well, which I still have a couple of pairs of those, but unfortunately, the gum leaf boots are, I think, headed the way of the heath hen, to give you an upland related analogy. I did talk to Jack Butler at Pheasant Fest, and he kind of got me up to speed a little bit. He was the importer of gum leaf boots in the USA, and I don't have all the details, but sounded like he was not getting new inventory from the factory, and the factory may in fact be shutting down. So that was kind of a bummer. I do still have my Viking neoprene lined gum leaf boots and the unlined or cloth liner version of those as well that I have been wearing on my daily exercise runs here in the muddy spring woods. I will likely wear those turkey hunting here in the near future, and I do still wear my neoprene lined Viking gum leaves that I have had since I think 2017. I've worn those boots a lot, and unlike some other kind of fake or less quality, air quotes, rubber boots, the gum leaf boots actually use high quality long-lasting rubber, and I got a lot of miles in those boots, and they are still waterproof and leak-free. So again, kind of a bummer. You can't get them, I don't think, anymore, and they were definitely a quality boot. But if you got a pair, or if you have an opportunity to get a pair, still a good recommendation there. But anyways, back to the Crispy boots, because that's what two Instagram followers of mine were asking. The Laponias, I bought them specifically as what I thought would be a sharptail hunting boot. Early season, warm weather prairie boot. But long story short, I've shared this before, I ended up loving those boots so much, I have pretty much worn them outside of maybe a handful of days that I've been wearing my aforementioned neoprene-lined Gumleaf Viking boots. I've worn the Crispy Laponia 2s every single day, sharptail hunting and rough grouse hunting for the last two seasons, because they are just a great all-around boot, more capable than I thought they would be, great support, excellent waterproofing, warm enough to wear all the way into December, January. I've worn them with gaiters in deeper snow, and they did just fine as well. The only time I don't wear them is when I know it is going to be very wet and cold, or both, and I'm just looking to completely seal out the elements with those Gumleaf boots. But other than that, Crispy Laponia 2s have been my go-to boot, and the point of me bringing this up today is Crispy has launched, I believe already, the Laponia 3, which is essentially the same boot, some upgrades to it. It's not a whole lot different, based on my understanding. But if you are looking for a good deal on a great pair of boots, you can still find, and this is probably changing by the day, but you can still find some of the Laponia 2 boots, especially if you are in not a common size. So if you're like me and you wear like a 10, 10 and a half, you're probably out of luck at this point. But there are some great deals out there, including earlier this week when I did a quick search on the Crispy Laponia 2, which I mentioned to both of the listeners that asked. So just a heads up on that. I have no association with Crispy boots other than I really like them. And I did meet and introduce myself to some of the guys at the Crispy booth in Sioux Falls at Pheasant Fest. I wish I got a commission for all of the Crispy boots that may be sold via mentions here on the Bird Chat podcast, but I do not. So that is just a personal tip and recommendation on a pair of boots that I really, really like and have been wearing for the past two seasons. So there you have it. Crispy Laponias. Go get them if you're in the market for a new pair of upland hunting boots. Okay, onto the show. This week, we are talking to former guest of the show, Maddie Rawlinson, dog trainer, upland guide, upland hunter, known for his string of spaniels and pointers. Caught up with Maddie last week and talked about some of his adventures last fall from the prairies to the mountains to the rough and rugged country of South Texas. Maddie and his pack of dogs have been keeping busy, and as always, he had plenty to share on the topics of upland bird hunting, dog training of both pointers and flushers, and much more. So with that said, let's welcome into the conversation and back to the Birdshot podcast of Heritage Gun Dogs, Maddie Rawlinson. Welcome back to the show, Maddie. As you were saying, I am one of those people that, you know, you tell me you live in California, and my first question I want to ask you, like, so do you surf then?
Yeah, I used to surf a lot, actually. I used to surf in England more than
ever.
Yeah.
Did we talk about that on our first time? I don't remember.
Maybe. I don't know.
Maybe one of our side conversations.
Potentially, yeah. Whether that was a smart thing or not, I don't know. I mean, I enjoyed it.
Dude, so yeah. have you seen the, I don't know if you're a show watcher, have you seen the HBO show Big Wave? Big Wave? Do you know what I'm talking about?
It might be. I think, yeah. You might be right.
Okay, because if it is, there's two seasons of it. I mean, for anybody out there listening, I think it's freaking amazing. I've never surfed a day in my life, and if the main kind of character, especially in season one, is this Garrett McNamara, who's like a Hawaiian surfer, and these people surf these big waves, and I think it's off of Portugal, kind of like where they set up shop. There's a dude in the show that's kind of Garrett's jet ski driver. His name's Cotty. And he's a UK, either Ireland or UK guy. And so they show some of that too. But yeah, that's a different world.
That is a long way from wandering around aimlessly with a shotgun and a dog. That's for right. sure. Yeah, yeah. That's quite polar opposites in some ways.
Yeah. Well, if you have since you have some surfing, if you do ever waste any time watching documentaries or shows, that one would be near the top of my list. Season 2 probably was out within the last year. It's really, really good. And just, I mean, surfing those giant waves is kind of insane, but it's also just a really well done documentary. And I don't know, I love that stuff.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check that out. I think, I don't know, I don't watch too much TV, if I'm honest, these days. Although my wife seems to be getting into, what's that comedy, Brooklyn Nine-Nine about the police.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's pretty entertaining. It's easy, light, you know, just light, easy watching.
I do think there's a place for that. I have never watched that show. I had it recommended to me recently, maybe by Del Whitman, actually. So there we can tie in shotguns a little bit.
There you go.
But yeah. Andy Samberg is hilarious, and I know he's in that show. So similarly, my wife and I, we do. If we get a chance to like actually sit down and watch something, we usually watch Parks and Rec, just because same show, you know. It just you could basically check out and laugh a little bit, and it's a funny show.
Yep. Oh, for sure.
But you've got dogs to run and better things to do, my friend. What's weather going to be like in California today? You guys in the 70s now?
I think yesterday we had like 7 or 8 inches of wind. So much so that I my kennels are on the outskirts of town, and I was driving into the kennel yesterday after running some dogs in the morning, and the storm was rolling in and it was just ripping windy. And I'm driving in and I'm looking and I'm like, there's a bunch of pigeons out. I wonder what the pigeons are doing out. And I was like, maybe I forgot to close the door on the pigeon loft or something. No, not to say that wouldn't be uncommon. I'm like, go up to the kennel, drop some dogs off, grab my side-by-side. I drive down there and know the pigeon loft had completely, the wind had just come through like a tornado and flipped it over. And, you know, then there was, so there was pigeons everywhere, and then there was tractors involved and lots of straps and towing things. And yeah, so it was, we're in the sort of spring, that weird transition of just like the winter's still trying to hold on, but spring's definitely showing up, which is great as far as I'm concerned. And then, so yeah, we're just kind of lots of pretty windy, but in the grand scheme of life, I can't complain about the weather too much here. It's almost always sunny.
Right. So, right. Yeah. The sunshine is not something you want to go. I mean, I notice how that you get a few days of clouds and then all of a sudden the sun peaks back out and you're just like, wow, that feels good. And we it's a bright, beautiful, sunny day here. So I'm soaking it up.
I would rather have I enjoy the kind of cloudy, the kind of more, misty days, I guess, or weather changing days are just kind of when you've come from from England where there seems to be like four seasons happening in one day and constant rain. I kind of welcome a weather change anyway.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And that is kind of a off season perspective there, because if it comes to, you know, ideal hunting conditions and days, you know, that could certainly vary. And, there's a place for a lightly overcast day and all that stuff.
Oh yeah, if it'd be 50 degrees and slightly overcast, I mean, even the lottery can't get you that. But it would be that'd be nice if you could have that most days throughout the hunting season, for sure. Yeah.
So is this a wild bird season for you? Are you getting out chasing wild birds, or what do the training days look like for you right now?
So training days for me right now, we are still in the midst of field trial season with the spaniels, so hunting season for wild birds for me ended in February. I was in, kindly got invited to Texas to go run some bird dogs down there on a kind of prestigious ranch called the Mariposa. So I got invited by a great guy. Who's up in your neck of the woods, actually, in Wisconsin, guy by the name of Mike Miller, who runs Six Gun Kennels.
Okay.
So he invited me down to Texas. I went down to, you know, If you're into kind of doing what I like to do, you hear a lot about Texas and how it's kind of the epicenter of kind of yep. bird hunting in a lot of ways and developing bird dogs and pointing dogs, etc. So I went down there to kind of discover what that was about. And I probably learned more about pointing dogs in the 6 or 7 weeks I was there than I probably have in 6 or 7 years. It was quite quite an eye-opening education. Mike was a great kind of guy to kind of hold your hand and guide you through certain things. Really good mentor. And then there was just obviously a lot of just working stuff out for yourself. What was more interesting to me was there were dogs that I was sort of went down there, you know, confident with, like, oh, these dogs are going to do great down here. They're mm-hmm. going to, you know, find a pile of birds and they're going to do X, Y, and Z. Then you get there and you throw a collar on them and you kick them out of the truck and they just trot down the quail road. And they're so overwhelmed by the terrain and the country that it's almost like that consumes them and they don't run. And then other dogs who you're just like, yeah, this one's kind of okay. All of a sudden, it's like, oh, this is my whole purpose in life, was to be in South Texas and, you know, run and be free kind of thing. So it was really interesting watching the different dogs, how they kind of adapted to the situation, really. And I've never, you know, people say, oh, Texas is like one of the hardest places to run a bird dog. And pointing dog, absolutely. I mean, yeah. Everything, and the main sort of takeaway from it, I think, is everything is going against the dog. Like the terrain, the snakes, the birds are hard. Like everybody thinks Bob White's are these gentlemanly birds. But
yeah, gentleman
Bob. When you have the Mariposa's kind of special in the fact that it's one of the true wild quail places. Like there is no management at all.
Really?
There's no feeding the roads. There's no burning. There's no nothing. It's very special and unique like that. And therefore the birds are truly, truly wild, which means they don't, you know, they wild flush. They do all sorts of crazy things to avoid, you know, predators essentially. And so that they're not very gentlemanly, and you have to have a certain kind of dog that can adapt to that country and terrain in order to get them pinned. And I had an interesting conversation with a couple of guys when I was down there. I like to know my, you know, go and visit people and talk to them, especially if I think they might know a lot more than me, which was definitely the case in Texas, South Texas. And what was kind of more interesting is, you know, we talk about lines of dogs, like, oh, which line of dog works, you know, oh, this, I like this kind of line and I like this kind of line of dogs and this and that. A lot of those guys, it didn't matter about the line of dog necessarily. It was just either that dog works down here or it doesn't. It was very black and white. It didn't matter if you had a Millerbred dog versus a Rebel dog versus a, you know, a setter from, you know, this line or that line. It was very much down to the individual dog. Did the dog run down there or didn't it? And if it did run, was it just running or was it hunting? Was it finding birds? There were a lot of, gosh, you could probably do a whole series of podcasts of South Texas bird dogs and how to train and develop them and things like that. But, anyway, I was down in Texas and then I got straight back from Texas and went, I got home and we were straight into, I'd skipped a couple of field trials because I was in Texas, for spaniels. And then, as soon as I got home, it was, we were full force training with the spaniels. And so that's predominantly, I hunt my field trial spaniels. I hunt them a lot on wild birds throughout the season. You still have to, it's still depending on which, you know, what the kind of the dog is doing, et cetera. It's still good to run them on a couple of planted birds or, controlled situations, if you like.
Just to really set up certain things and sort of proof certain aspects of their training.
Correct. Yeah. And because a field trial is is not wild bird hunting. There are certain things within a spaniel field trial that you do that you would never do whilst hunting, so to speak. And so if you want to play the game and you want to be successful, you have to train the dog in a certain way and handle it in a certain manner in order to make it be successful. And so, yeah, so there's along the way, there was kind of...
Can you give an example of like what one of those things would be that you wouldn't do while you're hunting, but you do in a field trial? I mean, it makes sense. Like when you're judging and competing, you're going to have parameters around it. So naturally, us as sort of improvement oriented individual, we're going to find ways to train for it and do certain things.
Yeah, a real two obvious ones spring to mind. When you're wild bird hunting, I might let a dog kind of get out a little bit further, or I might I'm on purposely walking to certain covers or certain areas of cover that I think look good that will hold a bird. In a field trial, you're just walking down. There is a course staked out for you. You're not just like wandering, meandering off like, this looks good over here, I'll just go check this out. There is a course laid out. You have to follow the course. And then if the dog does something, a dog in a field trial has to be steady. So when it flushes a bird, it has to be, it flushes it, then it sits. It has to be steady. The bird gets shot by a gunner. You have a gun team at a field trial. You as the handler don't carry a gun. The bird will get shot by one of the gun team, etc. And so there's not often the bird will typically get found by the dog. The dog will make the bird drive in and, have a nice hard flush the bird. In a wild bird situation, I'm sure you've witnessed this with rough grouse, etc., is you will get like what we would call like a bumped bird and things like that. Like a dog goes in the area and just because the presence of the dog is in the area will force a bird to flush, etc. That would be kind of one situation, especially with say valley quail or something like that, which I hunt quite a bit with especially my young spaniels. And so you might go, the dog might be in a bush trying, sort of actively pursuing one bird, but then a bird might peel out, just kind of wild flush off to the right, depending on where the dog is and the situation unfolding. I may choose to shoot or not shoot that bird, depending on if I want a retrieve for that dog or not. Or I might shoot that bird and I might have another dog with me that I might send for the retrieve whilst the other dog is still working another bird. So those are kind of some differences. Another major one, I think, is typically when a dog produces a bird and it gets flushed and it gets shot. While bird hunting, in a field trial, your dog will flush a bird. The bird flies away, gets shot. You as the handler have to just stand wherever the dog flushes the bird, you just stand there. The judge taps you. And then once the judge taps you, that's your cue to send your dog for the retrieve. When you send your dog for the retrieve, you have to stand. You just have to stand where you are. You can't move unless there's a situation that unfolds that the judge says, hey, let's move up a little bit and see what's going on, or maybe the dog didn't see where the bird fell, and then you have to handle your dog into the situation. Whereas in a wild bird situation, you shoot that bird, 9 times out of 10, you're not just, I'm not peeping the whistle and I'm like shouting the dog's name. And unless I think it's the bird is completely, the bird is killed outright and it's down over there, I will give it the benefit of the doubt and let it, try and handle it as if I was at a field trial kind of thing.
Yeah.
But sometimes that as hunters, we know that might not always be the case, and that bird might have some legs to it. Well, if that's the case, I'm like marching over where the fall of the bird was. We are the whole point of this is to recover game, right? So we're trying to get that dog into that bird to get that retrieve. That's and try and help it to be successful. Those would be the kind of the things. And the other kind of difference is a lot of guys who hunt there, they want to, it's about the dogs, but it's a lot about the birds as well. And so whereas to me, I guess I can only talk for myself, I have to be in a different frame of mind where I am trying to, how can I make this dog be successful, or how can I elevate this dog? And sometimes that might not mean shooting the bird, or sometimes that might mean, okay, I'm going to shoot the bird, but I'm going to send another dog that I'm have at heel for that retrieve. So there's some honoring. It's almost, you know, it's, yes, it's wild bird hunting, but I'm training as I'm going, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Just a different, it's not right or wrong necessarily. It's just a different approach. That's all. Yep.
Yeah.
So if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. And the other thing I would say too is, I mean, I see this with, I haven't done any of that really kind of trialing, but you just see how, you know, place oriented dogs are, and like they do things one way in a certain set of circumstances. But then if you show up to a new place and there's all kinds of people, you know, this is like little league stuff for you, like your dogs have been there, done that. But I've just seen enough to know, like, you've got to set some things up to just sort of acclimate and cross some of those bridges before you get to game day, if that makes sense.
100%. Yeah. I mean, if you didn't, you'd be silly.
Yeah. Yeah.
You'd be setting the dog up to fail from kind of the get-go.
Right.
That's really, and so I think wild birds really wild birds make a trial dog a great bird finder, and you will end up shooting birds and putting those dogs in situations that they wouldn't normally ever be in a field trial, which will potentially help them when they do get to a field trial. You know, they're used to dealing with perhaps tougher scenarios, or, you know, handling and things like that. Like, I might, you know, say I've got a dog is in a bush, and it's, you know, because in a field trial, there's typically only one bird planted out there. So the dog is not dealing with a covey of birds. So say I'm in Montana or something, and we get into a covey of huns. Well, I might shoot a double, let's say. And so the dog is on one retrieve, then you've got to call it back. Then you have a scenario where if you have a dog at heel, you can then set that dog up and line it out to then then you've got a blind retrieve potentially, or the dog that produced the birds in the first place, it can get a double retrieve and things like that, which doesn't often happen in a field trial, but those are great tools to have, to then be able to use in a field trial when, let's say, the dog, I had it the other week, actually, a dog flushed a bird. The bird kind of did a 180. The dog never saw the fall of the bird. And, you know, the judge is like, bring the dog in, you know, let's walk over here, handle your dog to the bird. And so there's that element of it. Whereas if you didn't practice handling drills and things like that, then you just stand there going like, I don't know what to do. My dog,
yeah.
You know, the dog is just stood there like, help. What am I saying? So yeah, you're just trying to help that dog become successful. So I don't know how many people kind of run their dogs, you know, sort of professional trainers run their dogs on wild birds, spaniel guys, I should say. But I do. I love to. I probably do it more than I should, maybe in some ways, in a funny kind of way. But yeah, I just would rather be walking around out there.
What would be like, because I think you and I have talked about this before, whether or not we went through it on the last pod, like the person that is, and I'm kind of asking you to talk for somebody else now, but if somebody says, I don't run my dog on wild birds because I'm a spaniel trial, like what would be the reasons that they might give, or I run them on wild birds less because is it just like, simply put, kind of like that unpredictability of it, and they would prefer more controlled
stuff? Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. The unpredictability of it, the dog becomes unraveled. A field trial is a game. So is wild bird hunting. It's a game, if that makes sense. It's just a different kind of game. And in wild bird hunting, especially, I can only speak for myself, way more unpredictable situations unfold. And I probably let my dogs get away with a few more things in those scenarios, whether it's in a field trial. If certain things unfolded, I absolutely would not let them get away with it, if that makes sense. So especially if we're training and things like that, trying to tighten everything up. And so these guys spend, you know, so many hours and time and energy putting into these dogs. The, you know, what they don't want to do, which makes a lot of sense to me also, is they don't want to then, all this time and energy they've put in to create this really, really, truly great finished dog, they don't want to then make it become unraveled necessarily and then have to deal with extra training. Maybe they're a lot smarter than I am. But yeah, that would be the, and I'm not, I don't know this for a fact, you know, I, it's hard to say, but yeah, there's just, that's just been my experience anyhow.
That makes sense. And everybody's going to have different priorities depending on what their goals are at the time and perhaps what time of year it is. Obviously you do a mix of both and you see both sides of it, different perspectives, and kind of figure out where your middle ground is.
Yeah, and the Spaniels are kind of I love them, and they're a funny breed in terms of, this would be an easy way. It's like a pointing dog for the most part. We're obviously talking very broad spectrums here. There are exceptions between the rules, but a pointing dog, typically you get it through the basics. It, you know, bird intro, e-collar intro, gunfire as a young puppy, 6-month-old dog or something. Then you take it out for its first hunting season. Hopefully by the end of the first hunting season or so, it's starting to point some birds. You can start killing some birds over it. Second season, it's kind of making some mistakes. It's doing some this and that. But by the end of the second season, let's just say your dog is like 90% there. Like you can pretty much put a collar on it. You can go out. It's going to point birds. Hold those birds long enough for you to get there. You can produce a bird, kill the bird, and maybe your dog likes to retrieve. I can speak for my dogs, my pointing dogs. I don't do, basically, unless I'm breaking them out and making them steady on birds, I don't really, apart from exercising them and making sure they're healthy, I don't do any other training outside of that. Like when my pointing dogs come off of hunting season, I'm literally roading them and I will take them for just like a walk up the hill kind of thing. I'm not going out there, putting pigeons out there and things like that. Once they've learned to ride the bike, they don't need to relearn how to ride the bike. Whereas a Spaniel, I feel, is you teach them how to ride a bike and then basically once they've learned how to ride the bike, they crash all the time. And you keep putting the stabilizers back on them. Or you're saying like, hey, we're going to ride off. We're going to go this way down this trail. And they're like, nope, I'm going down this trail. And you're just like, okay, well, God, you know, and so they are a dog in a very wonderful way that you, in order to get the best out of them, you know, if you constantly keep up with that maintenance with them, they're going to be, you know, they're just going to, that's just how their personalities are. And that's part of the reason why I love them. So that would be like another something else to touch on when people are just like, oh, you Spaniel guys seem to be training all the time. And it's like, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Because in the summertime, I've got a field trial coming up next week that I'm going to. But then after that, we're moving into late, you know, kind of spring, summertime. I'll basically be doing tailing. I won't be really shooting unless I've got like some young dogs that need it. I won't be shooting any birds for any of those dogs. I'll be doing a lot of summertime for me is kind of a lot of handling drills and shooting dummy launchers and doing all those kind of obedience type things and just kind of keeping them a certain level of maintenance with a lot of it was handling and retrieving. We move away from birds for the most part, like that, especially the older, more seasoned dogs. And I might notice something that they might have picked up a little habit along the way throughout the field trial season, that you might want to try and fix in the off season kind of thing. It could be like a delivery issue or something like that. You know, you're not quite happy with their delivery or you're not quite happy with, the way you line a dog up and send it on a retrieve or something. It might be deviating from its line a bit too much or just little things. It's all the micro things, I think. Too many people get hung up on the bigger things, whereas I kind of look at all the little tiny micro things that I like to kind of tweak and mess around with.
Yeah.
So I think that's an easier example of sort of what we do with the dogs, maybe.
Gearing up for your next hunt? Check out Ugly Dog Hunting Company for all your dog supply needs. Ugly Dog Hunting carries a full line of products for your bird dog and even some for you. Whether you're looking for dog collars, GPS tracking devices, kennels, beds, leads, training equipment, or first aid supplies, Ugly Dog Hunting carries it and a whole lot more. New owner of the company and Fred of the Birdshot podcast, Mike Nadusky, loves to remind me that while I do hunt with pretty dogs, every dog can be an ugly dog. Check out the entire selection of gear for you and your bird dog at uglydoghunting.com. For many upland hunters, along with their passion for dogs, birds, and the places we chase them, comes a passion for shotguns. Upland Gun Company specializes in customizing shotguns for the upland bird hunter, imported from Italy and shipped direct to an FFL near you. Select from one of their side-by-side or over-under shotgun platforms and customize the fit, function, and aesthetics to your liking. Design and build your next upland hunting shotgun with Upland Gun Company today. Visit uplandguncompany.com.
Going back to your bike thing, like, sure. would you say that is that because running a flushing dog or a spaniel, is it more of just more of a structured thing? Because I guess I want to look at it through my lens. I feel like when I go wild bird hunting with my pointing dogs, my English setters, I kind of feel like, you know, we've developed to this point where I basically strap the collar on them and I just start walking and they're doing their thing. It seems like a very freewheeling kind of experience, and obviously I'm waiting for them to go on point so then I can go in and then I can play my part in the game. It seems like when you're running a flushing dog, which obviously I've never done, there's just a bit more structure to it, kind of from start to finish. Like, you're just, it's more of an orchestrated thing. Like, is that accurate in your opinion, or would you describe it a different way?
No, I think that's a very that's a great way to describe that. Yeah, they're a dog that you have to, for the most part, constantly maintain. I mean, even some of my older dogs, sure, I can take them wild bird hunting and I don't, you know, or I can take them hunting or training. I don't need to do too much with them. But right. every once in a while, they're going to trip up or they're going to test you or they're going to do something. And so, yeah, it's more of a constant, they are pointing dogs and flushing dogs are so different in the way their minds work, especially with the handler. Like, with a flushing dog, you're a team, right? You're working as a team because the dog needs to stay within gun range to produce a bird for the handler to then be able to shoot the quarry for the dog to then make the retrieve. A pointing dog, yes, you still need that teamwork. You still need that. The dog still needs to be sort of working for the gun, if you like. But it's very different because you look on Onyx, right? And you're like, okay, I see this cool area. I'm going to walk off in this direction, da, da, da. The pointing dog still has to kind of stay out in front of you, hopefully, and stay to the front and follow you around where you'd like to go.
Yep.
But it's a lot more free thinking. Like, you're letting that dog, you're not handling that dog being like, well, you need to go and check that bush and that bush and that bush and that bush. You're letting that dog just kind of naturally meander through the cover to try and find a bird. Whereas as a flushing dog, you're a lot more, it's a lot more in tune with you and what you're doing. They're kind of, you know, they're keying off of your body a lot more, and they're kind of, you know, because they are right in front of you. And they don't point birds. Well, if you hope they don't point birds anyway. That'd be a major faux pas.
Unless you got a pointing lab.
Unless you go down the dark road and get a pointing lab. Yeah. Yep.
Are there pointing cockers yet? Has anybody crossed that bridge?
Oh, there's a few cockers that point, and I think those ones would be described as less desirable than others. That certainly wouldn't be a trait that I'd be looking for anyway.
How you described that though, because then it got me thinking almost like this, you know, in a way, like I am still orchestrating my hunt, but it's like I'm thinking like a sonar, like the pings between my connection to my pointing dog and me are there's a longer delay between each of those pings, but they're still swinging through and putting eyes on me and checking in, whereas the flushing dog is obviously closer in range, and those pings are a lot quicker and a lot more frequent. So, and I don't think, you know, we're not describing anything that isn't quite obvious. You'll hear people say all the time, I love my pointy dogs because I can let them loose and just check out and just throw the gun over my shoulder and just go for a walk. Whereas with a flushing dog, you kind of have to be more at the ready, to put it simply.
Yeah. And I think that's, when I'm running, I would say for the most part, the dog's on the ground, guns over my shoulder, and me and you could be having a conversation happily. Yeah. And every once in a while, you're kind of, throwing your head up, scanning the horizon. Oh, yep, there's a dog over there. There's a dog over there. Or you might be looking at your GPS and being like, okay, the dog's, over in this direction. Okay, cool. Or you might be like, oh, shit, it's behind us 300 yards. Quick, hang on a minute. I need to wrangle my dog and get it back.
Wrong way.
Because you were talking too much. You weren't paying attention. But hopefully, for the most part, the dog is out in front of you and it's kind of doing its thing. And then, your Garmin goes off or something, or whatever device you use that lets you know your dog is on point. And then there is a difference, right? Then all of a sudden you go and you click into a different gear and you're like, oh, the dog's on point. And then quickly the conversation ends and you're then walking in and dealing with the situation. Whereas when I'm running a flushing dog, typically I'm not, my gun is closed. And I am on what I would describe as high alert. Basically, like I am, my focus is fully on the dog. Like I'm watching its almost every movement. And especially if I think it's missed a piece of cover that I think that it shouldn't have, I am then directing that dog into that piece of cover, etc. And so you're a much more, it's just a different style of hunting. Some people prefer just throwing the gun over the shoulder and going for a walk and waiting for the device to go off, or say you physically see your dog go on point. You're like, oh, the dog's on point. You walk over there, you deal with the situation. Whether it's a flushing dog, the situation is, for the most part, once you get used to reading a flushing dog and like when it's on a game scent versus not on a game scent. But for the most part, I would say you're on much more high alert and you're in much more of a sort of a shooting ready situation versus not. At least that's how I am anyway. So I think that'd be if people are like, oh yeah, you want to go run some flushing dogs? Typically, like, so say me and you went to meet up and we're going hunting with pointing dogs. We could each put a dog on the ground and me and you could be, talking to each other side by side, having a conversation. Whereas if I meet up with somebody to go hunting with a flushing dogs, normally I'm working one area, kind of going up one little draw or something like that, or one area of the field, whilst that person is maybe, 50 feet away from me working another section of cover. Does that make sense? You're hunting together, but kind of not. You're sort of trying to divide and conquer, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And that's the way, not that everyone does it that way, but that's, in talking to Fritz Heller, he'll often kind of talk about going hunting with his brother where they're effectively side by side, but they're each working a dog and they're kind of within shouting distance, that kind of stuff. So that totally makes sense. And like I said, you just, it's a different level of intensity and focus than the casual stroll with guns on our shoulders and two pointing dogs casting out to left and right.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's it in a nutshell. Yep.
I love it. So you're a flushing dog guy first, right? And obviously, how long have you been running pointing dogs now?
Oh, since I got to the States, probably.
Okay.
Whenever that was, probably, I don't know, 8 years now, I think, something like that. Yeah.
Something you said earlier in the conversation really caught my attention when you went down to Mariposa, and I wanted to circle back to this. You kind of said you learned like as much as you've ever have, like in a short period of time, about pointing dogs down there. Like, talk about some of that stuff. What were some of those things that you learned and kind of that education, having that experience down there?
A dog applies itself to the country is huge. how much determination and grit a dog has. God, what would be a good example? Mike Miller said to me, I said, oh, I've got this female. She's doing this and this and this. And he just looked up and he went, yeah, it's a female. She's visual. And I'm just like, I kind of looked at him and went, what's that supposed to mean, Mike? And he's like, well, you know, females, they're always visual. They're always looking at everything. They're always, you know, tweety birds, this, that, and the other. And I'm like, okay. The next day I'm out running some dogs. The difference there is when you're walking on the prairie or you're walking with a gun over your shoulder in the Chukka country or something, your head's down, you're working, you know, you might be hiking up a hill, you just head's down and you're just like, I got to get to the top of this ridge. You're not actually looking at that dog 100% of the time. When you're in Texas, you have these great quail rigs and you get to put eyes on your dog every second it's on the ground. You get to watch it make every single move. And so Mike says this to me about this visual thing. The next day I'm running dogs and it just so happened I literally had like, I ran a bunch of females one after the other. And I just, after the third one, I just started laughing to myself. I was like, God damn, he's right. I'm like watching every single female zip around out there. Tweety bird gets up. Ooh, let's just chase that for a bit. You know, crow flies over in the sky. Oh, let's chase that. There's, you know, when near the ocean, seagull goes by, you know, they're like, you know, and I'm just like, God damn. And so it's little things like that. And then other things, like in terms of pressure, these dogs are so overwhelmed by the country. They have to run, you know, take your shoes off down there and just go for a walk out there with your socks on. You'll make three steps and you'll be like just in a world of pain. The amount of things that are like trying to prick you, poke you, bite you, kill you is like substantial. And so the dogs are having to, not only are they having to run and try and find birds, they're also like the floor they're running on is basically, you know, a million needles everywhere. Then they're also dealing with things like, you know, feral pigs and javelinas trying to grab them and attack them, plus snakes trying to bite them. This plant down there called sacawista, which is just this nasty, prickly, horrible stuff. The floor is sand, so the dog has a different type of traction. Like it can't move, like it gets, you know, if you think, you know, say there's a footpath along a beach. If you run along that footpath, it's substantially easier than running along the beach in the sand. Well, the whole thing down in South Texas is sand everywhere.
Really?
And so it's those
like
dogs,
soft ground like that?
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. So it's not like the prairie where they can really rip around out there. It's a different. So that's what I mean by everything is going against the dog. And it was all the, you really start to notice who your bird finders are. And which dogs have grit and determination. And so there's another guy down there, a great guy. He also lives in your neck of the woods, named by Bill Fromm, Bill's been, I think, you know, involved in cover dog field trials forever. Would probably be a great guest to have on, and really good dog man, has great dogs. And he would tell, you know, he told me, he's like, this is my best grouse dog, you know, go to a grouse field trial, etc. This one's going to be, you know, this is one of my best ones for the grouse woods. He's like, but that dog is not, you know, is just middle of the pile down here in on the Mariposa. And certain dogs just deal and elevate themselves better down there and acclimatize themselves better down there than others. I mean, I messed up a young, I say I messed up. I did. That would be completely accurate. I've got a young female who I was really high on. You know, I was like, oh, this, I really love this female. I love the way she hunts. She moves. She pointed a pile of birds in Montana. And when I got home, we had a great bird season. So she was, you know, the 2 days before I left Texas, you know, she moved 7 coveys of Chukka in a 2-hour hunt. And I was just like, oh my God, she's just killing it right now. And I was, you know, so I got down there thinking, oh, her name's Vivian. I'm like, oh, Vivian's just going to, oh, she's going to just knock it out of the park. That dog struggled so hard and it didn't help. I didn't help her. I put pressure on her. And when I say pressure, It wasn't me screaming and shouting and hot, like, come on, get out, you know, that kind of pressure that you're thinking. It's I wasn't helping her be successful. And literally helping a dog down there could be where you run the dog, how to get it into birds, or, you know, like a simple thing with her at first was like, oh, I need to put boots on her front feet to help her deal with the terrain. So she doesn't get, that is one element she's not thinking about. Mm. And then she went to, you know, that dog in particular went to, like, she was there for whatever reason. There just seemed to be a pile of doves down there this season. So she was, you know, she was so overwhelmed by the country, and because I was new there, I wasn't thinking about that stuff as much, but she started pointing doves in trees. She started pointing, you know, rats in around the cactus and things like that. So she would be on point. You'd go out there, she'd look great, and you'd be kicking around, and she would have an unproductive, and you as a handler would be annoyed about that. You'd be like, oh, come on, dog, what the hell's going on? You know, like, rrr. And it was like, okay, so what it is instead of then you go into a different mindset where you're like, okay, these dogs are struggling so badly, sort of thing. How do we show them how to be successful? How do we try and take some of the pressure off them? And instead of applying more pressure, how do we take the pressure off them to develop them, to show them how to be successful? And I basically, with that dog, Vivian, I'd put so much pressure on her, even to the point I was running with her with a flank collar and I was stopping her around birds. You know, I train with Bill quite a bit, and he's like, hey, how, you know, he's like, try it. You know, maybe don't run her with a flank collar. Maybe try this, this and that. And so I went from running her on her own with a flank collar, stopping her on birds and doing all of this, to literally, as Mike Miller would say, you got to let them get loose. You got to let them be loose. You got to let them punch a cover. You got to let them take this and that out, which inherently felt wrong, because I'd spent basically the duration of the hunting season preparing her for going down there. So I was holding her accountable and making sure she was steady on every covey, you know, making sure she was pretty steady around her birds and everything like that. And within after the second week, I realized all of that just had to go out the window, and I had to hit the reset button with her. And I took the flank collar off her. I let her knock and chase some coveys of birds. I put her on the ground with another dog to bring out some competitive side in her. We would have another dog on the ground. It would get pointed, and I would pull her off. I would keep her collar on. I'd just pull her off the truck and let her go in and get in and around some bird contacts, hunt some singles, things like that. And so instead of looking for a reason to, and we talked about this quite a bit down there, instead of looking for a reason to almost like get rid of a dog, people are too quick to go, oh, the dog's not doing this, we should just get rid of it, start again. It's like, well, let's look at why a dog is doing a certain thing. And is it something that we caused? Quite often, yes. And then how can we help that dog? Instead of looking for a way to like get rid of it, how can we help that dog keep it and elevate that dog and get better? And then, so it took me about a week to mess this dog up. It took me about 3 weeks to really kind of, it took me another week to realize what I'd done. And it took me another 2 weeks of basically training a lot with her, very specifically doing very particular things with her, to then ironically get her back on track to where she was when I first got there. And I think the biggest thing, it sounds silly, but one of the biggest things I learned down there was there's so much going against the dog. Don't be afraid for them to get loose. That would be That's a Mike Miller line every day of the week. Let them get loose. Let them punch a covey. Let them, like, you got to
basically
let them,
just, the, it, it, this is hard. Let the dog, like, cut the dog some slack and
100%.
Let it go and see how we can mold it together. Correct. Basically. Yeah.
Correct. Absolutely. Yeah. And some dogs have it and some dogs don't. It's really as simple as that. Some dogs want to run down there and some dogs, I mean, I had an older dog of mine, she's like six, great wild bird dog of, you know, she's pointed, I don't know how many, a lot of cubbies, right? She's just a good bird finder. She would barely get off the quail road there. You know, I really had to like baby her along and help her. She was so overwhelmed, didn't want to run. And then I had, you know, other dogs, young dogs that were the polar opposite, who were just, they were out 500, 600 yards. And another thing, you know, that we could talk about that is I had these two setters in for training from a great client of mine, and they would take off and just, I would look at my Garmin. I'm like, oh my God, that dog's 600 yards out there. Holy shit. And, you know, Mike would be like, you know, I trained with him quite a bit too. And Mike would say, your dog's not finding birds at 150 yards. What gives him the right to be out there? If he can't find them and point them at 150, 200 yards, he doesn't need to be 600 yards out there. Start right. Handling your dog. Start making him hunt and work for the truck. And I think we get so obsessed with a pointing dog, like having to run big and doing this, like making these big casts and punching into the country and doing all this kind of stuff. We forget about the fundamental of just like, well, if he's exactly that, if the dog isn't doing it at 150, 200 yards, it hasn't earned the right to be out there at, you know, 500 yards. And that country is so big out there, 500 yards. And you can kind of, it's weird. It's very flat. So you can kind of see for quite a ways.
Yeah,
500 yards is substantial. And so you don't know if that dog's chasing deer, chasing mule guy, chasing all sorts of weird exotic animals they have down there, or chasing tweety birds, or it could have found a covey of quail and taken it for a ride. You have no idea. And so it was interesting, you know, just like, oh, and, you know, and one of the most basic things that became apparent to me that Mike mentioned was like, if your dog's not handling for you, it will never point a bird. It's always something. So it was like an indirect thing. Like if your dog isn't doing something, if your dog's not doing one thing, it's probably there's a knock-on cause behind it, which means why it's not doing something
else. Yeah, it's kind of like how you do one thing is how you do everything. I mean, yeah,
correct.
If it's not a part of the team in one facet, it's likely not in other facets.
Absolutely. Yeah. So if your dog is just, you know, at first I was like, oh, sweet. Look at my dogs. They can run down
there
here.
There they go.
You know, there they go. Literally. But that's all they were doing. They were running, right? They were like, oh, there he goes. You know, I'm just watching a number on my Garmin. I'm just like, wow, look at him go. He's really out there. And I'm like, huh, I wonder what he's doing out there. You know? And so it's like, I actually don't know. So you start handling him and you start basically certain dogs like that who can run down there. You start hacking on them. And you start making them handle for the truck, and all of a sudden they go from chasing tweety birds, trying to take down a mule guy, which is like a massive antelope thing, getting in a fight with a feral pig, to running and pointing quail. Quite frankly, you go from all of those things to and so that was a great thing to learn, and it's really hard. It's honestly probably that I'm sure people will beg to differ with me. That's fine. Until you truly go down to South Texas and you run dogs down there, you think, you know, I didn't think I went down there with the best string of dogs or anything like that. But I thought, you know, like I guide people professionally. I do this.
Your dogs hunt quite a bit. You spent 3 months before you headed down there, basically.
I think I got some pretty good dogs. And you go down there, and within the first week, you are severely humbled. And it's just like, oh, this is hard. This is really hard for the dogs. It was significantly harder than what I expected. And, you know, for the first, I think, I had a very humbling first few days where, you know, I got given a truck and, you know, okay, here's this pasture, go out there. There's, you know, I hated it. There would be like, you know, another guy, Bill or Mike would come back and, oh yeah, we found 4 cubbies out there.
Right.
Like, so I would, you know, they'd be like, yeah, you should go in there tomorrow with with your dogs and, you know, try and, cause they were trying to help me get into birds to be successful. They're not trying to make you fail. And so I would go to that pasture the next day or whatever, thinking, okay, well, they found some birds. There should be some birds in here, you know. And they were literally to the point where, like, see this corner in the road and see this tree here. They're right by there. I'm like, okay. And yes, so I would go around. Well, the first 3 or 4 days, I don't think my dogs even didn't even find a bird, didn't even go on point. They were just running. And it was, and I was just like, just severely humbled by that, because I thought, oh, I'm going to go down there. They just, you know, they're just going to be stacking up all over the place. Ding, 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 pointing birds. My dogs can kind of run. They're used to running in nasty chukka terrain and stuff. And it's just a different deal down there. And yeah, I think the biggest thing was letting my dogs get loose, as in like letting the reins come off them a little bit, yeah. Letting them take out, don't be afraid to let them take out some birds. You know, let them relax, let them feel good about themselves. How can we make these dogs feel good about themselves? Because everything is against them. I think that was the sort of the grand takeaway from it. And just, you know, you think you got some really good dogs, and then you go down there and you get to run with, you know, I was down there with four other guys. And I've also visited other places. I visited other people at other ranches and just, you know, getting to see different dogs run, different types of dogs run in different, you know, every ranch has a different feel to it. And there's nothing quite like South Texas. It's quite a special place. And it's a true testament to a bird dog. Like if somebody told me like, hey, I've got a dog that can run 300 yards in South Texas and to the front, and it gets pointed all the time on birds, I'd be like, I don't care where that's from. I don't care who it's out of. That's probably a very, very good dog, no matter where you take that dog. Yeah. That would be the kind of the outtake of it all, I suppose.
It's kind of making me feel like I need to plan a trip to South Texas.
Never a bad thing it's a truly humbling experience. But then once you kind of get, you have to leave your ego at the gate and just go in there with an open mind. And I'm like a sponge of information. Like, you know, I was probably that annoying kid down there. You know, I was like, well, tell me more. How do I do this? How do I do that? Like, I want to know. I'm not just like, oh, I'll figure it out, you know. So ask a million questions. And I would try and train a lot. I obviously go out by myself, but I would try and train with other people too, because I wanted to see how they handled a dog or how they would deal with a certain situation, because those guys have been down there a lot longer than I have. They're going to know. They're going to have a trick or two up their sleeve, you know. Yeah. That's really it was a great experience.
It sounds like it was for you, like you and your dogs. It sounds like it was kind of perfect, just because it was something new, different, challenging. I mean, you need that stuff to grow, and I think that's at a higher level. It's really what you're getting at too. Like it's pretty well known. Like as far as you know, improvement, learning, adapting. We and dogs, you know, probably any animal of survival stuff, like you do well under regulated levels of stress. Like a little bit of stress is a good thing. That's how we overcome challenges and get better. But that can quickly go upside down on you with too much stress and too much pressure. Then the body, the brain starts to kind of shut down and you get tunnel vision and you don't learn in those scenarios. So it kind of sounds like that sort of played out with your dogs, but, and also it was sort of that similar experience for you. Just, it was a challenging thing, humbling, as you say, but it was something that you got exposure to and experience with, and have no doubt you and your dogs will be better for it for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's a very good, analogy.
So did you have any run-ins with snakes, javelinas? Well,
you know, I got really, I got lucky. I never saw a snake, didn't really see too many. Luckily, only one sort of weird thing, and weird things always happen with bird dogs. I was running some dogs with Bill from, and this setter I had just came running back and to the truck and was just covered in blood. And I was like looking at the dog and I couldn't quite work out, and it was all over its front leg. And I was like, oh, it probably hit, you know, some barbed wire and kind of sliced its leg, you know, kind of its lower leg on the, and I was looking, I'm like, oh, but that's not where. And I looked up and there was a huge hole in its neck, and literally blood was pumping out of it like a fountain. And I was just like, oh God. So I was like, slapped my hand on it, jumped on the truck with the dog, Bill rallied back and we kind of got you know, I was able to get the dog to the vet. But outside of that, that was, apart from the sand burrs and the cactus, I got, touch wood, I left there pretty unscathed in terms of that stuff. But there's definitely, the more dogs you own, the more dogs you handle, the more weird and wonderful things happen, the more dogs, you know, end up getting hurt, injured, run away, do all sorts of weird and wonderful things. You know, if you think about it, it's like, I don't know how many dogs you're going to own in your lifetime, Nick. Let's say you're going to own maybe 10 dogs in your lifetime, potentially. Right. Maybe 10, 12 dogs in your lifetime, right? So you'll see, whereas I was down there with 30 dogs. And so you're going to end up seeing just more weird and wonderful things.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
You know,
the odds of something weird and wonderful happening are going to be way more in your favor, especially when you're running dogs, putting dogs on the ground every single day. Yeah. That's just the nature of it. Right.
Yeah. No doubt. I do think about that from time to time. And again, that's why, what I love about this podcast, talking to people, because, you know, my sample size is limited and, you know, I see lots of things and love hunting my dogs, but I know, like, I'm not out there every single day and I'm not running nearly as many dogs as somebody like you or many of the other people that I interview. So obviously I value that perspective, but I'm always thinking, like, man, it's hard to believe how rarely the dogs do get injured or hurt and weird and wonderful things happen. I mean, it seems like it could happen on a daily basis. So every day it doesn't, you're kind of lucky. But I had a dog, well, Rose ripped a toenail out on ice this winter. And just one of those things had never happened to me before. But to your point, that kind of stuff can happen any day. And it was just a basic exercise run around here in the winter. And, you know, the risks are pretty low where we're doing that, which is not always the case where you're running dogs. So yeah, it's that kind of stuff it comes with the territory, and you know that as well as anybody with 30 dogs.
Yeah. You definitely end up becoming a sort of a mini vet, if that makes sense. You're like, oh, this dog's a bit sick, give it this. If this dog's doing,
you gotta do what you gotta do.
Yeah, for sure. Because often the places we are running dogs are not that convenient to get to a vet. You might be an hour or two away from one. So it kind of definitely helps to have a little knowledge in your back pocket of kind of what might be going on, which just, you know, really comes with experience, I guess. And having, I'm fortunate that, I have a great veterinarian where I live. She's a kind of more of a country style vet, and she's just fantastic to work with. I feel very lucky to have that, because I've definitely dealt with some other vets where I'm just like, I know what's wrong with the dog, can you just prescribe blah? And they're just like, nope, who the hell are you? You know, which in their defense is completely fair enough.
Right.
But anyway,
I feel like there needs to be like some sort of a bird dog / country vet finder app or something, because every bird dog person wants one, but they're hard to find.
Absolutely, yeah. And then typically, if you do find one, you're a little quiet about it because you don't want
right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, if all goes according to plan, this will be the end of part one, and we will hear from Maddie again on next week's episode.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Onyx Hunt is the number one hunting GPS app. Join millions of other hunters who trust Onyx Hunt to find more game, discover new access, and hunt smarter. Onyx Hunt shows you nationwide public and private land boundaries. They've got topographic and 3D maps. You can track your route, location, and elevation profile. You can save maps for offline use and take Onyx Hunt with you wherever you go. The most comprehensive hunting tool you'll own. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your next Onyx Hunt subscription. Know where you stand with Onyx.
Hey everyone, this is Nick from the Gundog It Yourself podcast. If you enjoyed this show, then you might want to check out my show as well. We highlight and break down the ins and outs of training your own hunting dog. Whether it's a bird dog or even the occasional hound dog episode, we cover all topics related to hunting dogs. Check out Gundog It Yourself on any podcast streaming platform and hit the subscribe button to be sure not to miss any future episodes.